Coming up on Boston Public Radio, it's 5 years this week since banks too big to fail failed the nation. Has anything changed or any of the masters of the universe in jail? Allison Fitzgerald from the Center for Public Integrity will join us. From titans of the financial world to bag ladies, that's what nearly half of American women fear they will be someday. Are you and Marjorie among them? And then tonight starts the three-day WGBH Wine and Food Festival. This evening, it's the Chef's Gala. Two of the celebrated 25, Jody Adams from Rialto and Brooke Vosica from the Four Seasons, join us.
Christopher Lydon on the ART's latest production starring Breaking Bad's Bryan Cranston. It examines President Lyndon Baines Johnson, great champion of civil rights, but disastrous war president. Then Kara Miller on Brilliant Innovators. What makes a creative genius in history and now? Kara's analysis and yours. Up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
I'm working into a frenzy.
Well, we're going to be. When it comes to PR, the banking industry isn't doing itself any favors. A new report from the advocacy group US PIRG has ranked three regional banks in the Boston area among the 10 worst in the nation in terms of complaints. Put that against the backdrop of the five-year anniversary of the financial crisis, where the banks that were too big to fail failed the nation, if not the global economy. Joining us online to go over where the big financiers are who left us with a housing crisis, a sluggish economy, and chronic unemployment is Allison Fitzgerald. She's the project manager of finance and states at the Center for Public Integrity. She wrote a recent piece entitled Ex-Wall Street Chieftains Living Large in a Post-Meltdown World. It's part one in a great series on the 2008 financial crisis 5 years after. Allison, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Allison, I got to tell you, I read your piece and I felt like such a fool. Silly me. You know, I thought some of these guys would be in jail or at least lose a lot of their millions or at least have to give up their $10 million beachfront home in Florida next to golfer Tiger Woods or their $8 million nine-bedroom home in Greenwich or their 40-acre ranch out in Sun Valley. That's just Richard Fall, the guy from Lehman. Nothing seems to have happened. Update us, please, on Mr. Fault and the other guy from Bear Stearns, which almost collapsed before it was sold to J.P. Morgan. How are they doing? How are they doing, Allison, in 2013?
Well, I would say they're living quite comfortably. Those two, they're not really working. Dick Fault tried to start himself a business, but according to the people who know him and have stayed in touch, it's not exactly booming. People aren't knocking down his door to do work for him. But like you said, he still has three spectacular homes, and I'm talking absolutely out of this world. They are classified literally in tax records as mansions. And they're in, you know, the best places in the world to live. Greenwich, on the coast of Florida, on this gorgeous barrier island right on the beach. And, wow, you know, this beautiful ranch in Sun Valley, Idaho, right at the bottom of the gorgeous ski hill. So
it's tough.
But Allison, suffering. I have to say, you and Marjorie, I hate to criticize, but you're heartless. I mean, the guy had to sell his $26 million penthouse in Manhattan. I mean, that's tough for
terrible.
Him, is it not?
And a huge profit.
He made money on that, and I'll tell you, there aren't that many people who made money selling real estate in 2009 or 2010, and he managed to make about $5 million on that property, which was...
You know,
plus the salary, and bonuses. Tell us how much he made between 2000 and 2007, this guy from Lehman Brothers.
Well, he made, I mean, there's sort of what he was awarded and then mm-hmm. what he brought home. And there were a lot of people who were feeling bad for him because of the amount of money he lost when his stock in Lehman Brothers went to zero. And he did lose hundreds of million dollars that day. However, he had managed to take out of Lehman, in terms of stock sales, bonuses, and salaries, over $500 million in just those sort of 7 years leading up to the bankruptcy.
Allison,
he was awarded almost a billion, but he took home half of that.
Allison, before you tell us about the guy from Bear Stearns, the round two of this picture, Are these guys pariahs in any part of the world? There was a great piece years and years and years ago on the front page of the Sunday New York Times Magazine about how all the executives of the cigarette companies have to live in one compound. I'm exaggerating a little because they really can't go anywhere. And not are these guys pariahs, or are they just playing golf and just living the high life?
I think there's a mix there. I mean, compared to their former status, they've clearly gone, you know, their status has fallen in the business world. They are not looked upon as sort of the chiefs of finance anymore. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, sought out for their professional advice, at least not all of them. However, you know, reports that I've seen, you know, they are being invited still to some dinner parties and, you know, some conferences. Dick Fuld's keeping a very, very low profile, as is Jimmy Cain, the Bear Stearns CEO we've referred to.
Give us a quick version of what's his life like these days, his deal?
He's a quirky character. He is an avid bridge player, and avid might be an understatement. People who know him, who also are big bridge players, say he is online almost every single day hosting bridge games. You can do these sort of electronic bridge games. And he also continues to play at the highest levels. He has a bridge team. In August, he was in Atlanta competing in what would be considered a sort of national championship type bridge tournament. And he, you know, he hires his team. He's a very good bridge player, but he also hires the best in the world to play with him.
Is he living on Social Security benefits? Is that how he's surviving?
He's got plenty of money too. He also took out several hundred million dollars in terms of, you know, his salary, bonuses, and the stock that he sold before Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan for a song. And he has a $25 million apartment in the Plaza Hotel in New York. So that's some nice.
$25 million.
Yeah, he bought two and combined them. So that's,
you know,
why,
Allison,
it cost so much.
You know, we want to talk about why, as you write in your piece, none of these people were prosecuted. But I think part of it is, at least my analysis, reading what you've read in some history, is that the president seems to be in some ways fascinated by these guys. He praises Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein from J.P. Morgan, Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs. Correct me if I'm wrong. The first state dinner that the president had, which was for the president of India, if I recall, Lloyd Blankfein was an honored guest shortly after this disaster. So is that part of the reason none of these guys not only went to jail, but none of them were even prosecuted?
You know, I can't say, you know, whether the president had any hand in this, because I don't know that for sure. But, you know, there does seem to be sort of an institutional hesitancy to prosecute people, to threaten to take away their freedom. And that is frustrating to the rest of us, and especially to those people who lost their homes and lost their jobs and lost their savings during this crisis. Because, you know, especially specifically in the case of Lehman Brothers, because it went bankrupt, there was an exhaustive report done by an attorney in New York named Anton Valukas over how this happened. And he specifically laid out causes of action that could be taken against the company, against its executives, and said, Dick Fuld was, quote, grossly negligent. The question, when I've spoken to lawyers from the Justice Department, what they have told me is that it is very hard to prove criminal intent in these situations. But what I think most people, and I get the sense of, is that they didn't try very hard either. They didn't, they didn't really take anybody and prosecute them to see if they could.
Well, even, you know, even civil liability, you must cite the $90 million settlement that some Lehman investors had, not a penny of which comes out of Fuld's pocket. I want to quote something from your great piece. There's this guy, Bill Black, who's written a book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He says, this is the greatest white-collar fraud and most destructive white-collar fraud in history. We've found ourselves unable to prosecute any elite bankers. Here is Eric Holder, the Attorney General. You quote him in your piece, too, in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee in March.
I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, It will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And I think that is a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large.
Wasn't he embarrassed to say those words?
Yes, it's like we talked about how they were too big to fail back in 2008. And now in 2013, we're still saying it.
Too big to prosecute is what he's saying.
Begging the question, why aren't they breaking these banks up? I mean, that's what's incredible. Your piece is so enraging, Allison. I'm beside myself reading all these things. And you also point out that a lot of these guys, they're not exactly pariahs in the business world, because the guy from Citigroup is on the board of directors of Xerox and Johnson & Johnson. The guy from Merrill Lynch is on the board of Alcoa. So they're pulling in nice salaries there. So obviously it's another case of these business people at these high levels still taking care of each other.
Right. And if you talk to people in the industry, they'll be like, well, they are still very smart, and they have a lot of experience and expertise to share, which may be true. But I mean, their most obvious experience is that they almost ran their companies out of business. Charles Prince, the former CEO of Citigroup, and Stan O'Neill, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, I think, you know, perhaps benefit from the fact that they resigned about a year before the crisis sort of became apparent to the rest of us. Their companies had each lost billions in the fall of 2007, so it was nearly a year before Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, and they're the two that you mentioned are still sitting on corporate boards out there. I don't know what kind of advice and oversight they are giving these companies, so I won't prejudge that. But I don't know what people see as their long lasting reputation that they want them to be, you know, listed as a leader of one of these companies.
Allison, one last question for me, because I think a lot of people, besides the really nauseating greed that you've outlined so beautifully in your piece, a lot of people are afraid. You know, people that were on the tip of retirement back in 2008 saw the 401ks that they had and going to rely on for their retirement. Mm-hmm. Cut in half or worse. They lost all their retirement money. And when you read that 5 years later, we've done nothing about these banks that we bailed out with billions and billions and billions of dollars, you wonder, can this happen again?
Well, there's a huge ongoing debate about that, because laws have changed in terms of what the government is supposed to be able to do and what is supposed to happen if a bank does get into trouble. I think there's no doubt that the banks that remain are bigger and more powerful and therefore more too big to fail than ever. The question is, if they start to falter, what will happen? The Dodd-Frank law, the financial reform law, supposedly put in place a system in which the government could take over a company and wind it down, put it out of business if it starts to become a big problem and collapse, so that it won't cause the destruction that Lehman Brothers caused and it won't require a bailout. But nobody will know until that happens, and I'm afraid that nobody really wants to see that.
Well, one thing we do know for certain, though, both of you, is if it does happen, no one's going to be prosecuted. Hey, Allison Fitzgerald, thanks so much for your great piece and your time.
Yeah, Allison,
thanks for having
thank
me.
You. Allison Fitzgerald is the project manager of finance and states at the Center for Public Integrity, where she wrote this brilliant piece you've been talking about, Something Everybody Should Read. So you're bothered by all this, the fact that these masters of the universe are still living large in these waterfront mansions with 17 bedrooms and 9,000 bathrooms, that they paid almost no price for this debacle. And whom do you blame for this? And are you worried, as we asked, that it could happen again? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Personally, Jim, I'm hysterical about the entire thing. I'm a nervous wreck. It's going to happen again. What didn't I mention?
Not you. What we didn't mention with Allison, in addition to the fact these guys have escaped criminal liability, civil statutes around fraud, statutes of limitation have expired, so it's over. They have gotten away scot-free with what they did.
And when there were these suits, the insurance companies paid off
not a dime out of their pockets.
Not a dime out of their pockets. 877-301-8970.
877-301-8970. What do you think of Eric Holder's quote? What did you think of
I think he looks like a fool.
This is March. I am concerned the size of some of these institutions, becomes so large, it does become difficult for us to prosecute them. Even if he believes that, that's the Attorney General of the United States, isn't he embarrassed to utter the words?
Well, and Barack Obama inviting these people to the White House, I think he's totally intimidated by Wall Street. Not that I'm obsessed by everybody's houses, but let me just point out this Jimmy Kane guy from Bear Stearns, the one who pays his bridge partners more than $100,000 a year so they can keep on top of their bridge games, so we can rise in the ranks of great bridge players. He did lose $900 million in paper when Bear Stearns' stock plunged. However, he got about $289 million in stock between 2000 and 2007. So he's got the $25 million Plaza Hotel condo. Then he has a second apartment on Park Avenue. They put that house on the market a little while ago, he and his wife, for $14.95 million. And when they want to get out of New York City, they can retreat to their $8.2 million mansion on the Jersey Shore. And when it gets cold, Jim, they can go to their $2.75 million condo at the Boca Beach Club.
You want to be a little more aggravated before we take some calls?
Sure.
Here is Barack Obama, you just mentioned a minute ago. He's heaping high praise on J.P. Morgan and their CEO. What show do you think he is saying this on? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, Jay Leno?
The View. Here he is on The View in May of this year. 4 years and 9 months after the Lehman Brothers filing for bankruptcy started this near meltdown, here's what he has to say about the CEO of J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon.
J.P. Morgan is one of the best managed banks there is. Jamie Dimon, the head of it, is one of the smartest bankers we got. And they still lost $2 billion in counting, precisely because they were making bets in these derivative markets. We don't know all the details yet. It's going to be investigated. But this is why we passed Wall Street reform. This is the best, or one of the best managed banks.
Right.
And by the way, the reason, the proof that they are some of the most competent CEOs in America is none of them went to jail. 877-301-8970. I have to say, you know, I get riled by a lot of things. There's virtually nothing that puts me over the edge by the fact that not only we haven't even mentioned, you mentioned briefly talking to Allison Fitzgerald a couple of minutes ago. Remember the tired line, my 401k is now a 201k?
Exactly.
Well, the stock market has obviously come back with a ferocity. The reality is the economy is not back to a great degree. People are still suffering. Millions and millions of people suffered. And other than the fact that most of these guys lost their jobs or retired from their jobs, they paid, as you said, no price for their malfeasance.
And they're on the boards of these distinguished companies.
Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Not all of them, but a lot of them are on these board of directors, and they're making money from that. And don't forget, obviously, all the people, all the thousands and thousands of people who lost their homes, all the thousands and thousands of people who lost their jobs. The unemployment rate is still huge. People know with kids getting out of college now, a lot of these kids getting out of college are not able to find jobs in their careers. I mean, it's just...
But do you want a constructive outcome here? I mean, let's talk about some of the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people, for example, lost their homes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say about 4,000 of them could live on the 40-plus acre ranch in Ketchum, Idaho, that the former head of Lehman Brothers considers amongst his holdings. 877-301-8970. What's your take on this? One, are you surprised none of these people, forget in jail, were even prosecuted? Does it trouble you like it troubles me and Marjorie? And are you worried that 2013 or 14 or 15 could become 2008 all over again?
Let's go to Tim in West Newbury. What do you think, Tim?
Good afternoon, guys. I have two little brief anecdotes to pass on. Number one, I remember when George W. Bush was president and Enron...
Ken Lay, right?
Enron exploded, and George W. Bush got on TV, and he said, my aunt lost $8,000. And there's a few bad apples in every barrel. Well, I read the business pages every day, 7 days a week, and it's been several years since Enron exploded, and I can't recall a day when I didn't read about some malfeasance in the world of business. And the vast majority of them are the financial industry. Just today, I've just read two stories, one of them about J.P. Morgan Chase, how they're paying the Securities and Exchange Commission and other entities over $922 million for bad behavior in the trading business, which is nothing but gambling. I wish that the media wouldn't call it trading. The Wall Street can call it whatever it wants. It's gambling. That's what these people do. So I read another survey or a story earlier this week about the kids going into Harvard. And that's Harvard, the best and the brightest, and Harvard School of Business, and Tuck, and up in Dartmouth. 25% of these kids are already cheers. So they get out in society, and they haven't been trained in ethical moral behavior. It's unconscionable.
It's great
ethical
you brought that into it. That
moral
was a great
behavior.
Point.
You know,
thanks,
Tim, there was a story on the front page of the New York Times last Sunday talking about, we all complain about the oil prices going up and you're paying more at the gas tank. This story talked about one of the major reasons that oil prices are going up is because Wall Street is manipulating the price of ethanol, and ethanol makes up 10% of the gasoline now. So it never occurred to me. I was always blaming the oil companies or blaming somebody else. Well, they're now manipulating ethanol, killing the budgets of people that, you know, have to drive like 200 miles a day,
you know,
because they've been unemployed for 5 years and they have to go to another job.
One of the other problems, and Tim, thanks for the call, is Allison said to us, you know, the criminal statutes are such it's very hard to prosecute the leaders of these companies. Martha Coakley, we've had this discussion with her many times, like her $500 million settlement with Bechtel and some of the other big dig contractors. State and federal laws have to change so that if there are CEOs who are responsible for the criminal behavior of their companies, that they too take a hit, as opposed to having the investors or the stockholders paying some fine, which does no damage to these characters.
Let's go to Sam on the cell phone. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Sam.
Great topic. I enjoy your humor, but I think today it's a little bit misplaced. There's just really nothing funny about this story. I mean, I like gallows humor as much as the next person, but to me, what this really, or where we should be talking about, is the fact that the government is broken. It's totally broken. And until regular Americans realize there's absolutely no point in voting, the system is so totally corrupt that this will just continue, because there needs to be a sea change. We're back to the robber baron days, but the times are different now. The government doesn't work anymore. With so much money in politics in a way that it's never been there before, there is no hope unless there are actual structural changes.
What would they be? I mean, neither of us agree with you about this no voting thing, but putting that aside, give us one major structural change that might help fix what ails government, Sam.
Come on.
No, I'm not challenging. I'm asking.
Okay. All right. No, I mean, everyone knows the answers. This is, you learn this in sixth grade. You got to have all elections to be federally funded. You have to get rid of the Electoral College. You have to make gambling by the banking establishment illegal.
You can stop there. I agree with
70 years with Glass-Steagall.
I was out a lot of the days in sixth grade. I agree with every single one of your prescriptions, Sam. Thanks for the call. We talked about public financing of elections yesterday. What were we talking about yesterday? It led to that.
I don't know. We've talked about public financing elections a million times. We're not really getting very far on that front. You know, we disagree about this, but I think one Elizabeth Warren.
You mentioned term limits again?
Elizabeth Warren, who's been talking about banks nonstop since she got to Washington. And she's talking.
Disagree at all. I'd like her to talk to us in addition to talking about banks and writing op-eds.
But I think that one of the reasons she was one of the key players who we got an email from Bob asking if she went after these guys as hard as she did Larry Summers. Bob said he'd be impressed. Well, Bob, she has been going after these guys. I mean, she's been on the Banking Commission talking about it nonstop. And I'm glad, because Larry Summers was the guy I thought Glass-Steagall should be getting rid of him. He was working for Bill Clinton as the head of the Treasury Department. And as I always say, I'm not an economist, but from everything I've read, it was not a good idea for the average taxpayer that went by the board. So I'm glad Janet Yellen could be in line for the head of the Fed. Yes. Let's go to Barry, who's driving in the car. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I saw a Frontline episode a few years ago called The Warning. Did you ever see that?
Yes.
Maybe. You did?
This is the one about Wall Street?
Yeah.
That focused on that John Thain guy?
It's focused in. There was a bank. There was a bank situation that on Wall Street. That there was a bank going down on Wall Street, and so Alan Greenspan decided that the best thing we could do now would be to save these banks. So save this bank. So he had a consortium of banks buy that bank. So essentially, he had deeper pockets, save the little guy from drowning. Brooksley Bourne, who was the first female graduate of Stanford Law, said, "You can't do this stuff. This is going to blow up in your face. And if we don't get these things that are off the books on the books and stop the banks from doing all this stuff behind everybody's back, we're going to have a bigger problem." So 10 years later, we had the bigger problem, which was the fall of the banks. So then the solution that we came up with then was to find deeper pockets, the U.S. government, to bail everybody out again. All we did was take a problem 10 times larger and do the same thing that failed years before. So now, my question is really about quantitative easing. the Fed buys $85 billion worth of U.S. debt
every month. Every month, yeah.
Where does the Fed get their money? Isn't this a shell game?
We're going to call Ron Paul and ask him the question.
Trying to figure out what quantitative easing is.
Hey, Barry, thank you for the call. But it's, by the way, when I heard the number yesterday, when they said that to the surprise of Wall Street, which caused the stock market to go to record highs, that the Fed agreed or decided to continue doing what he said, buying $85 billion in bonds a month, I had the exact same reaction. Someday we'll get a tutorial here on the Federal Reserve.
You know, he mentioned that was not the movie I saw. I saw the one about the fall of Wall Street, which
you talked about it to me for days, if not
Elliot
weeks.
Elliot Spitzer was featured in. Elliot Spitzer was
in a good way.
Then, of course, the Attorney General, and he was the governor of New York State. And many people think that one of the reasons he was caught with the hooker was because there were some people from Wall Street out to get him. I don't know if that's true or not.
I mean, it's been some speculation that
because he was after them. But you don't see politicians after them. That's why I was mentioning Elizabeth Warren before. Andrew Cuomo has done some stuff in New York State going after Wall Street, mm-hmm. but not nearly enough. And Elliot Spitzer, I was rooting for him, despite his hooker alliances, to become the controller in New York City because he seemed to be one of the few politicians who was going after Wall Street. And it's interesting how we've talked about this before, Jim, how Barack Obama seems to be totally intimidated by Wall Street. And FDR, the classic line from Franklin Roosevelt when he was the president, when he talked about how much Wall Street hated him, and he said, "I welcome their hate." I don't get the feeling from Barack Obama that he can stand up to Wall Street, and that's part of the reason we're in the mess we're in.
Let's take one more.
Peter from Attleboro. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, I share your outrage, but another thing that outrages me is that as a small business owner, sometimes I get checks written from certain clients. When I go to their institution to cash the check, the first thing they say to me is, "Are you having an account here?" I say, "No." They say, "Well, it's going to cost you $5," and that's where it started. Now some of them are charging $7. My question is why are banks who don't really need this money taking advantage of people like this? I mean, the only
because they can, Peter. That's why.
That's a great point.
Why isn't somebody standing up to these people and say, "Look, what's the purpose of the only one that's going to suffer as a result of this are the poor"? You know, I mean, they're the ones who may not have enough.
You know, but Peter, when you said why aren't people standing up, and you can name individuals who are giving good speeches about it. One time in the last couple of years, on a related note, when the public stood up, do you remember when Bank of America, I think they weren't the first, but they were the highest profile, established these not quite usurious, but totally inappropriate, excessive fees on using ATMs, on debit cards, and that sort of thing. How long did that last? It was like a $5 fee. It lasted a week because the public went absolutely berserk.
They did.
It wasn't the politicians leading the charge. It was the public. So I guess maybe, again, we have to wake up. Peter, thanks for a fine call. We appreciate it.
I would like to point out, though, that Ken Lewis, who used to run the Bank of America, of all these guys we talked about with all their many houses that worth, you know, billions of dollars, he apparently only has one house.
How much is that worth?
Well, it's worth $4.1 million. It's a condo on beachfront high-rise in Naples, Florida. And he did sell a couple of other houses and make huge profits. But he's living modestly in his $4.1 million condo in Naples, Florida.
I wonder if he has direct deposit of his Social Security check or if he just waits by the mailbox for it to come every month.
I don't know. Okay, we've been talking about the masters of the universe. When we get back, we're going to talk about the other extreme of living, something worlds apart from Wall Street execs and their multimillion-dollar penthouses. And that's the anxiety that so many American women, wait till you hear this, I'm one of them actually, we're worried about becoming bag ladies. How Woody Allen's movie Blue Jasmine taps into our fear of living on the edge. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
We, 20 years ago, had a horrendous problem with gun violence. Today, it's much less, but still remains a problem.
WGBH News political analyst David Bernstein.
And there's a sense that Tom Menino has brought the city a certain distance, but now someone with new ideas has to step in and bring it to the next level.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Subaru of New England, introducing the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. And Skinner, presenting American and European works of art at auction, Friday, September 20th, featuring paintings, prints, and photography. The auction includes original works by FitzHenry Lane, Alexander Calder, and others. SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Let's go from $20 million Manhattan penthouses, which we just discussed, to the street, and I do not mean Wall Street.
I'm dead broke, really. I mean, the government took everything. Anxiety, nightmares, and a nervous breakdown. There's only so many traumas a person can withstand till they take to the streets and start screaming.
Never mind screaming in the streets. How about living on the streets? The clip, obviously, from Woody Allen's latest film, Blue Jasmine. And the conclusion you draw at the end of the movie is that she could very well end up homeless. In this Sunday's Times magazine, the New York Times, Lisa Schwartzbaum, I hope I got her name right, writes the following. Blue Jasmine hit me and depressed me silly. This is true of so many women I know. We can intuit Jasmine's fate because ending up a bag lady is our darkest and claimest fear. And then listen to this. I was stunned. In this survey in March of this year, Marjorie, nearly half of American women said they feared becoming bag ladies.
That's right.
And that number included more than a quarter of women who live in households making more than 200 grand a year. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, are you one of these women? We're going to find out, is Marjorie one of these women? I know she is. And if you are one of them, why are you one of them? 877-301-8970. When you read that survey and it was almost 50%, tell me you were not knocked off your feet.
No, no. I was totally validated. I mean, we've known each other for a long time. What is my longstanding fear that I've confessed to you over and over again?
Homelessness and old age.
That I'm going to wind up at Melnia Cass Boulevard collecting cans like the people I've driven by my whole life, giving them a buck here and a little bit, and, you know, they want food. And that's
what you really feel. That.
I think, do you know something? I read this story Sunday in the New York Times. I'm sitting in bed. I read the story. I thought, my God, I'm like millions of other Americans.
You emailed
women.
Me like at midnight.
I am not alone. This is and then since then, I've talked about this with a bunch of girlfriends, and some of them have been on the edge. Some of them are from my hometown, who kind of struggle, but others of them are like me. They went to college, they went to good colleges, they have professional careers. Some of them are married, some of them are not married. It is a huge fear because, and I think it's a leftover, well, it's a product of many things. It's a product of people not having pensions anymore. That's one big thing that can support them. It's a product of people not being married anymore. Or even like in Blue Jasmine, when she had this husband that was a master of the universe and she was living large, then he ends up going to jail because of his high crimes and misdemeanors. And she's left to have to move in with her sister who's like going out with some guy that's an auto mechanic somewhere making $10 an hour. So I think it's a real fear. You're not going to have enough money to support yourself when you get fired from your job, which we're all going to be sooner or later.
But almost 50% of women in America fear this, including 27% of people who live, women who live in households where the income, annual income is more than 200 grand
a year. Absolutely. Well, that, see, the thing is also that the husband that supported them all these years, or maybe not, I mean, many women support themselves, so not everybody has husbands that support them. But like in the movie, the husband that supports you is going to run off with a 21-year-old secretary, and he's going to get a much better lawyer than you. So you're going to wind up getting totally shafted.
And then you hope
divorce.
He goes to jail at the end of the story, like hers did.
No, you don't want him to go to jail because she would have
at least had
some money to support her. But instead, you know, they get the better lawyer than you, and you wind up with a lousy divorce settlement. And then there you are, 40 years old, and you have no skills. And what the hell do you do then?
Is Cate Blanchett as great as everybody says she is? I haven't
She's
seen
fantastic.
It yet.
She's fantastic. The acting in Blue Jasmine, and I know everybody has mixed feelings now about Woody Allen because, of course, he's marrying his stepdaughter, Sony, which wasn't very nice thing.
It's not formally a stepdaughter. It's his de facto stepdaughter. Well, but I agree. No, but I agree
enough.
With you.
It's a stepdaughter for all intents and purposes. But anyway, the movie's really good. Great. It's not a happy ending. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. We kind of know, based on what we're talking about, the acting's great, that you should absolutely see it. But the bag lady thing, I had friends of mine call me and say, God, I thought I was the only one, and now I know millions of Americans lie awake at night. American women, by the way, lie awake at night worried about ending up on the street collecting cans. In my case, it's on Melnia Cass Boulevard. Frances from Providence, what do you think about this?
Well, her fate in the movie, I mean, it couldn't happen to a nicer person. and to him, and what he did to Andrew Dice Clay, that character,
yeah,
they deserved, I mean, these people deserved everything they got. I don't get it. I had more faith in her sister as a human
Francis,
being than her.
But Francis, you're right. She wasn't a very nice person. But that's not the real issue. The real issue is that millions of American women who are very nice people, who've worked very hard and managed to stay in their little life, saw that movie and identified with winding up, sitting on a park bench, muttering to yourself. And, of course, you know, as she mutters to herself, the person next to her looks at her and thinks, oh, my God, and leaves.
Yeah, leaves.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do, but, you know, make sure you have joint accounts. You know, keep your money separate from Al Baldwin. You know.
Hey, Francis, thanks for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let me break down. I'm speechless about this poll. Not only did nearly half of all American women fear becoming bag ladies, break it down. 56% among single women fear it.
Yep.
54% of divorced women fear it. 47% of widowed women. And 43% of married
That's
women
That's right. The lesson there is, it may not be perfect. Stay married. Your chances are better, even though, you know, the husband may be a little bit tough to take sometimes. But at least you have two Social Security checks in that case. You know what I'm saying?
I do. 877-301-8970. It's perfect. We start today talking about, as Marjorie called, the Masters of the Universe, obviously, from the great movie Wall Street. That was from the Vanity Fair. Bonfire of the Vanities,
Tom Wolfe's
one of the
book.
Great books ever.
Yes.
Masters of the Universe, who are not going to jail, who are living not in the lap of luxury, they're owning luxury, to this survey, which suggests
because
that women are in panic about being out on the street.
Because lots of women, are and men as well, but lots of women are afraid they're not going to be able to support themselves in their retirement. How many people do you know that feel confident about their retirement, that they're going to have enough money?
You know what's wrong with this piece? They should have compared it to men. If you had to guess... If you had to guess, is almost 50% of women fear it. What percentage of men would admit the same fear?
Well, I don't
know
if they'd admit it because men are supposed to be self-sufficient.
Let's assume they were sodium pentothal was administered, so they had to tell the truth whether they wanted to or not. What percentage do you think would be anywhere close to that number?
I don't know.
Even in an economy that is precarious?
I think you hear a lot of men joking. I read a great piece somewhere a couple of days ago about people talking about what they were going to do in their retirement, how few people really think they're going to be able to afford to retire. So they're going to have to work, you know, 2 days a week at the liquor store and 2 days a week at the gas station and supplement their Social Security and stuff. Because the other thing is, who's going to give you a high-paying job when you're 80? I mean, very few people. But now people live to be 80 and 85 and 90. And, you know, God, Jim, that's a long time to be collecting cans.
Let me just say, and this is obviously ahead of the game, for anybody listening, no one bags as well as I do. No, I'm serious. I mean, not now, but just I can really bag. 877-301-8970. Janine, you're in Rhode Island. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And thanks for the call.
Well, thank you for taking it. I wanted to say that I did not have a fear of becoming a bad lady until you started this piece, and now I'm terrified.
I'm sorry, Janine. You know, we call it, the title of the piece, The Fear That Dare Not Speak Its Name. We don't really want to admit this, do we?
That's
to
the
our
name
buddies?
Of the, that's literally the name of the piece. Yeah.
But, I mean, so you're nervous now, too. So am I, Janine. You're not
alone.
No,
but why were you immune? Seriously, Janine, you're in the 50% who didn't have this fear. Why not? We don't want you to, but why do you think why do you think you didn't?
I guess I never got that far along with my fear. Like, I fear from day to day about things, and we're okay now. So I didn't take it to the level of bag lady. And so because we have a big family. So I always thought, you know, if anything,
sure,
I'll rely on them. So we're lucky in that regard. But
yeah.
That's why.
Well, Janine, stay strong, and thank you very much for the call. We're sorry for the effect that
you have to hope the children will bail you out. You know what I'm saying?
That is the hope.
That one of them makes it well enough that they can throw you a few bucks here and then if things get tough. But, God, Jim, you never know.
When one of your kids decides to major in philosophy, you have to basically sit down with them and say you have a responsibility to your parent.
Why did you say that? My oldest daughter majored in philosophy.
True. Is that
true? Philosophy
but now
and comparative literature.
She's in business school
Thank
and
God.
Graduate school.
Thank God. It's my only hope.
301-8970. Astrid, you're in Malden. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Astrid.
I don't know why everybody fears that if they don't retire on like $250,000 a year that they're going to be bag ladies. I mean, frankly, people have this idea that it's either you're making huge, huge amounts of money or you're making no money at all and you're going to be homeless and on the street. It makes absolutely no sense at all to me. I think that a lot of times people have this idea, and one of the problems, you know, we're in just in terms of our consumerism, is that we are just, we think that a, you know, barely getting by is, you know, on $60,000 a year for a couple.
So how, don't go away. I want to hear Marjorie respond to that. You basically have to have more modest expectations, and then you won't have the fear, is what Astrid is saying.
But I do think, Astrid, that one of the fears people have is that they haven't saved enough for their retirement. And it's the rare company that's going to keep you on until you're 70 or 75. And if you retire at 65 and you live to 95, that's 30 years, you know, of having to pay taxes. Now, if you, even if you have no mortgage, you're still going to pay taxes. You're still going to pay your health care costs. You might get some, you know what I'm saying? You might get a catastrophic health situation that your insurance won't cover. I mean, I hate to be like Debbie Downer here, but, you know, this is what keeps me awake at night, Astrid.
I think you're being poly-privileged, not to be snarky. But I think that a lot of times people just, they think that they have to have, you know, complete everything in that, you know, I have to be able to, you know, have the new car, and I have to be able to, you know, buy clothes all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, how about it, Polly?
Yeah, Astrid, you're talking to the wrong person.
No, but actually, in Marjorie's case, you are talking to the wrong
person. I don't think I'm buying
but
new
Astrid,
cars
thanks
and
for the
buying
call.
A lot of clothes. I'm just trying to get by. I'm trying to stay off Melanie accounts.
But by the way, there's some truth in what she says about people's expectations, but there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. Pensions, a generation before, almost everybody had a pension.
Exactly.
Pensions, at least defined benefit pensions, are virtually a thing of the past, except for older workers or those in very lucky industries with lucky companies. People worry about their 401ks. People don't understand finances. I mean, I get what you're saying. Ruthie, you're in Cambridge. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hi, how are you guys this morning?
Great. Thank you for the call. Well, I'm great. She's not, but I'm
doing
fine.
I'm in a panic, Ruthie.
Poly privilege. No, we'll skip that. Okay, so I'm pretty much your – I wouldn't go see the movie because I'm so worried about this that I didn't want to see it on screen because this is my life. I'm
actually is that true?
Well, yes, I'm on my way to a job interview right now as I'm talking to you guys. I'm divorced. I'm nearing 40. I chose not to have children and do not want to have children. So I cannot rely on those, say, traditional sort of ways of you know, quelling my fears. So basically right now, what I have to do is rely on myself. And I have to take the next however many years that I am a viable employee somewhere and make sure that I rely on myself to make it happen. Because I am the only thing that hinges on, you know, the fact of me becoming that bag lady or not. I took a risk to open a business, and when it closed, I had to, you know, absorb all of the financial ruin of that. And so now it's me. I've got to put up or shut up time, and I've got to make it happen. So kind of terrifying.
You know, Ruthie, the girlfriends and I who have talked about winding up as bag ladies, we have an idea if it really gets down to it that we'll all live together. We'll all move in together and it'll be like the Golden Girls on television. It'll be at least six or eight. It may have taken a couple of boarders, you know, but that's our idea. Open like an old age hostel kind of deal.
Hey, Ruthie, before you go away, what's your confidence level like in yourself and your abilities? I understand the fear, but is there a confidence level internally
absolutely.
As well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Here's what it is. I know how far down I've been, which means I know how far up I can climb. So great. I'm ready to kill it.
Good luck in the job interview today. Call us back soon and let us know how it went. Good luck to you.
Regis, by the way, just emailed and said he guarantees that 50% of men who are being honest are worried that they'll be homeless too.
That may be true. Allie, you're in Braintree. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Do you have the fear, Allie?
Yes, I do. I am a recent graduate, so I'm in the younger demographic.
Yep.
And I want to go into social work, and I'm looking to apply to a master's program in social work, which, you know, as you guys probably know, they don't make a lot of money.
They do not.
And my boyfriend is a physician, so he makes, you know, in the $250,000 a year range. We live together, and we've been dating for 4 years, not to get too personal, but, you know, he's encouraging me to go down this path of social work, and he wants to support me, and he says, you know, go to the private institutions where you're going to get a great education. And it's scary because I'm like, if we're not married, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether I'm going to end up in 40 years paying back $70,000 for a graduate degree. And I could be, you know, I could end up being the people that the social work people need to help.
So, Allie, how is this? How are these concerns impacting a word I hate as a verb? I don't know why I use it. Affecting your decision-making about graduate school, about jobs and that sort of thing. Are you just plowing ahead or what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm plowing ahead. I'm a good candidate for a graduate program. So that's in, you know, I have that going for me. But at the same time, I already have undergraduate debt. I have about $40,000 in undergraduate debt, and the competitive program that I want to get into, like I said, is $70,000. So I'm gonna graduate at 30 years old with $100,000 in debt, making maybe $55,000 a year if I'm lucky. So it's scary, and my boyfriend's fine. He's gonna be fine. He's gonna just keep climbing the ladder. He's an emergency medicine doctor, so it's scary for somebody who wants to continue on the education and have a job with good, or an education with great job placement. But at the same time, I'm not going to be making that much money, and it's very scary to have the encouragement. And at the same time,
Allie,
you know,
I think you got to issue the ultimatum. You know,
I knew you were going
to
say
okay?
this.
Okay, been together 4 years. It's time to put up or shut up, Dr. So and So. We need to get married.
Hey, Allie, good luck and thanks. You know, by the way, I'm so glad she brought up another factor. You and I are talking about pensions. I wrote a piece, you know, a couple of weeks ago in the Sunday
college
Globe
costs.
Magazine about college costs. They are approaching mortgages as the second greatest liability of Americans. 37 million families, I think it is, roughly have them. It is a real serious problem. It affects decision making. It creates fear. And, you know, we had this big debate in Washington over whether the interest rate would be 6.4%, 6.8 or 3.4, which has nothing to do with the underlying issue of the costs themselves, which are out of virtually everybody's reach.
You know, when we started this conversation earlier at noontime, we were talking about Dick Fuld, F-U-L-D,
former
the guy that used
Lehman
to run
Brothers,
Lehman
yep.
Brothers. Listen to this email from Linda. She said, at 63 years old, my fear of homelessness is a direct result of the fact that I worked for Lehman and Dick Fuld. My pension, which should have been $2,500 a month, is now being administered by the government, and it's worth about $137 a month. $2,500 a month to $137 a month. I am one of the thousands of employees in the situation. You can be sure that Kathy Fuld, his wife, does not have this fear, nor do her children. Dick transferred their multimillion-dollar Florida property to Kathy for a dollar shortly after Lehman declared bankruptcy, and she is all set.
That is an incredibly powerful email. And if, for contrast, a few people just tuned in. What's that woman's name again, Marjorie? What's her name?
Her name was Linda.
Linda did not. Just to put it in context, if you weren't listening to the top of the show, Dick Fuld, who was the head of Lehman Brothers in 2008 when it filed for bankruptcy, which began the near meltdown, has an $8 million nine-bedroom home with a guest house in Greenwich, Connecticut, has a $10.6 million beachfront home in Jupiter Island, Florida, has a 40-plus acre ranch in Ketchum, Idaho, and he and his wife sold their penthouse in New York City and Manhattan for $21 million, making a $5 million profit, and has never paid a penny in restitution, never been fined by a court, nor has he been charged with any criminal offenses. Contrast that with Linda.
And I did not even realize until Linda called that their pensions went basically under and were taken over by the government. That is an awful story. And that's why a lot of us are afraid about winding up on Melnia Cass collecting the cans. Okay.
I was shocked by the response. I have to say, I'm shocked by the story. I'm shocked by the response
you
of listeners.
You thought I was crazy.
I didn't think
I'm
you were
not
crazy.
I'm not so crazy. Yes, you did.
No,
but that's okay,
that
Jim.
You're a little less than I thought.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chef Jody Adams and Chef Brooke Vosica about They're part of this year's Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This week on Innovation Hub, we examine the challenges of paying for healthcare and one ubiquitous solution that's probably within arm's reach.
I continue to see the trend of prescribing lots of apps and very little in the way of medications, relatively.
I'm Kara Miller, a prescription to cure our healthcare system, tonight at 9 on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you.
And Merrimack Repertory Theater, kicking off its 35th season with God of Carnage by Yasmina Reza. Two sets of parents meet and try to settle their son's dispute like adults. Now through October 13th. Tickets at mrt.org. And This Old House, this Emmy-winning series allows you to follow the experts through the complete renovation process from beginning to jaw-dropping end. This Old House, Thursdays at 8 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Bradley. She is Marjorie Egan. Tonight here we are kicking off the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival. It's a three-day affair. Tonight is the Chef's Gala. Here with us in Studio 3 are two of the chefs who are part of the event. Jody Adams is a James Beard Award-winning chef, the creative force behind the restaurants Trade and Rialto. Hey, Jody, nice to see you.
Nice to be here with the two of you.
Brooke Vosica is the... She didn't say the three of this. Let's see what she thinks of this guy in a couple of minutes. Brooke Vosica is the executive chef at Four Seasons. He is the most tenured chef in Four Seasons history. Great to see you, Brooke, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Jim Meyer. Thank you very much.
Can we get to what matters? Forget, we had a lot of questions for you. Forget the questions. What'd you bring for us, Steve, Brooke?
Let's get down to it. Yeah, he was really smart. He brought food.
We'll get to you in a minute, Jody.
Hey, look, it's lunchtime. You know what? It's lunchtime, and we went right out of Bristol Lounge. We brought you a couple of snacks to have.
What do you have?
What are those snacks,
please? And we got an avocado fry, a little green goddess dipping sauce for it.
Oh, my goodness. I'll be
right
over.
And then some ahi tuna tacos.
So, of course. What else would he bring?
You know what?
Now, Jody, are you embarrassed that you brought us nothing? I'm serious.
Totally shamed.
Humiliated, right?
Absolutely.
That's okay. But it's okay. I read about this woman in Boston Magazine, 100 hours a week. I hope you're not still working 100 hours a week.
No. Well, depending on how you determine work.
Yeah.
You're thinking about it. Is that the point? Is that the
No, I work on other things, you know. I'm not in the restaurant, certainly, 100 hours a week. But I feel like I work about 100 hours. Don't you? I mean, you're always thinking, right?
I guess I'm always thinking.
Yeah,
that's part of work. I try to zone out.
Don't you want to ask her if she fears being a bag lady? Continue. What? Come on, Jody. Let's
no,
get
I'm
this
working 100 hours a week, so I'm not going to be a bag lady.
So tell us what is going to happen. What's going to happen here tonight and all weekend, right? The WGBH.
Tonight's is Chef's Gala. That's their thing. 25 chefs. Yeah. You're two of the 25. Why are you doing this thing, Brooke? What's in this for you?
You know, it's great. For a couple of reasons. One is we get together and see each other. I mean, I see Jody at these events more than anything else. We're all working at the same time. We're all tucked away in our kitchens at the same time. So we get to socialize also. Plus, we get to show off a little bit.
Are you competitors or comrades? I'm serious. How do you see other successful restaurateurs? Both things?
Yeah, both.
But... Yeah, we have to be competitive, right?
So why are you here? Is it the same reason, the social thing?
It's definitely social. I mean, it's all about connecting. You know, WGBH has done this great thing for the local restaurant community. We have amazing restaurants in Cambridge, Boston, Alston, Somerville, around. And it's really wonderful to be celebrated by this established organization that makes a huge difference in our lives and that we've been supporting for years. I know I have. I've been listening to WGBH since I was probably about 13 in Providence. So, or longer. So, and I know that I've always supported it. So it's nice to have that sort of symbiotic support. So
and by the way, for people who don't know, there are 25 chefs. These are two amongst them. They'll bring some extraordinary food. We're going to hear what you guys are bringing in a couple of minutes. There is wine pairing going on, all these kinds of wonderful things. And there's still a couple of tickets left for tonight. We're going to tell you how to get them in a couple of minutes. What are you bringing tonight, Jody Adams?
I'm bringing something that my chefs would like me to tell you is called Smack-a-fam.
Ooh. Of course, Smack-a-fam.
Smack-a-fam. Doesn't that sound interesting,
yeah,
right? So currently at Rialto, we're an Italian restaurant. We're focusing on Trentino Alto Adige, which is up near the Germanic part of Italy. And this is a dish traditionally served at this time of year that's it's very hearty. It has polenta, it has sausage, it has sauerkraut. And we've deconstructed that into a rather less homey version. So they're the beautiful venison sausages, homemade sauerkraut, and some polenta, and then a wild huckleberry sauce.
I'll be over there.
Did you cut your hand with one of your chef knives?
No, this is long-term injury in my thumb that's resulted in arthritis.
Oh, so okay.
You're not supposed to comment.
I'm sorry.
Like, I'm not on TV.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I figured you had sliced yourself this morning.
I didn't put on any makeup either.
That's okay.
Why don't you ask Brooke about his physical ailments, too, Marjorie. Okay, Brooke, what do you bring? I'm going to eat some of this while you're talking. What are you bringing tonight with you?
You know what? We're going to go with a little New England twist, and we're going to use lobster, but we're going to do it with a lobster wonton. and then the little twist on this, a little ponzu sauce with it. So it's a crowd pleaser, mixing a little bit of Asian with that New England. But then we took some of our rooftop honey that we're doing on top of the Four Seasons Hotel, and we're going to drizzle that rooftop honey on top of that lobster wonton and ponzu sauce.
Tell people about what you're doing on the roof of the Four Seasons Hotel.
You know
I
what?
Have no idea.
This is so exciting for a chef to be able, in the middle of Back Bay, where there aren't that many trees unless you're growing right to the common, to turn around and on top of that roof grow as many wildflowers as we can, which is what we're doing, and then having a rooftop garden. And then now we have 50,000 honeybees that are up there, so in four different hives.
How do the guests feel about the 50,000 honeybees
on top of the hotel? Screens are really important to us right now.
Yes, I bet they are.
So that works out well. But you know what? When you really learn about the plight of the honeybee and what's been happening and how the numbers have been depleted so often, it's really great for us in the city to bring them back. And I'll tell you this, our wildflower garden has never bloomed like it did this year. So hopefully that's spreading out into the common, and you're going to see a lot more blooms as more of these hives pop up in the urban areas.
What am I eating? Tell me again.
You've got an avocado fry and then a green goddess dipping sauce.
Oh my God.
So, you know, I've always wanted to do something with avocados that was warm.
So
and
funny.
You know what? Crispy avocados. It's just a great
Jody, you want to try this and give us a review?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is Jody Adams is going to give us
a restaurant
review.
I'm not competitive when it comes to eating food.
And Marjorie, here they come if you want to try.
Can I eat it now? I'm afraid I won't be able to talk.
Well, talk first. And then
okay.
What do you think, Jody, first of all? Give
fabulous.
Us a little review.
And the sauce is amazing.
It is amazing.
Okay, we're talking to Jody Adams, a James Beard Award-winning chef and the creative force behind Trade and Rialto, and Brooke Vosica. I got that right. Vosica, did I not? Executive chef at the Four Seasons. And the reason we're talking to them is going to be this big event tonight, the Taste of WGBA. Food and Wine Festival that you're both going to be at. You know, I wondered about the whole change in I'm not a big foodie, but I know everybody's becoming big foodies. And we have become like almost, we've kind of exploded in the last few years in Boston. There's tons of great restaurants here. But when you first began, it was totally different.
It was. I started 30 years ago. And, well, there were some great restaurants. There was Seasons, where I got my first job. There was L'Espalier. There was The Harvest. There was Allegro. And forgive me if I've forgotten some others. And then, of course, some well-established restaurants like Legal Seafood and Durgan Park and places like that. There was a force at that time to work with local farmers. We started working with them, you know, 30 years ago. The Harvest was a restaurant that really celebrated local food. When you think Harvest, you think local food. So there was already a beginning. And now to see what has where we are today is so rewarding. The fact that the Four Seasons is growing something on their roof, the fact that the Boston Medical Center has a roof garden, schools are getting roof gardens, that people are reclaiming parts of Dorchester and Roxbury and growing their own gardens there. Nothing tastes better than food that you pull directly out of the ground that's grown in healthy soil. I mean, you don't really have to do very much to it. That's why I love cooking Italian food, because they don't mess with something that's already pretty perfect. And it's, I mean, so exciting what's happening, not just with the big restaurants that are opening down by the seaport, but all the little ones like Astra and, well, Puritan and Julia in here in Cambridge. Just,
you know, you're also finding a lot of artisan chefs that are opening their own little spots. I mean, you've got this New England charcuterie with Joshua Smith, who's opening up now, that took the idea of these old curing meats and really doing pastramis and doing sausages and the copas and the salamis and doing them all from the artisan old-style recipes and bringing that back. And I think that's something that was lost and is being lost with everyone buying things that are prepackaged.
Is this local farm thing? A good friend of mine is the executive director of Farm Aid, which is having its concert this weekend with Willie Nelson and focusing on the family farmer for, I guess, 26 years now. Is it about the quality of the ingredients, or is it a political statement about supporting small farms, family farms? What's the motivation, Jody Adams?
I think, to begin with, it's a political, but it's also a sustainable problem. It's an issue of health. If we don't grow healthy food, if all our food becomes industrially produced food, whether it's animals or fish or vegetables, we move into monoculture land, and we also end up with meat that is horribly handled and also has horrible things in it. So I think it's imperative that we shift things to family farms. So it becomes a health issue, but then, of course, it's a political issue, too, because we have to actively do that.
I think, you know, the CSAs now, these community-supported agriculture areas, when you're seeing these things pop up and support them, when we can go down the street and buy what we want fresh for the amount we want when it's not prepackaged, that makes such a difference. And for a chef to do that, now, you know, I think the future is going to be a lot of these urban farms, as Jody was saying, in Dorchester and Roxbury, taking these areas, getting good soil to be donated in there and planting within that area, that urban area. And if you can farm something like zucchini in an area like that, I'll pay for that. I'll buy that.
Can you taste the? You know, can you taste the difference?
Yes.
Marjorie says she can.
I think you
something
can.
It's fresh. Jody is shaking her head up and down. You can. Yes.
Yeah, but you got to tell me you can't. When last time you were at the store and you buy a chicken, you roast a chicken off. Sometimes the chicken's got a great amount of flavor to it, but there are often times when sometimes it doesn't have as much flavor, and you got to wonder sometimes. The same with vegetables. Why are we losing the nutrients in the soil? Mm-hmm. Why is it coming out that way? So I think by supporting, you know, local stuff, you're really getting back to knowing what a vegetable should be.
So Brooke Vosica from the Four Seasons. I want to know, we were talking yesterday about this other new trend, these tasting menus. And we had a fellow in here who was very critical of them, Corby Cummer, saying that you go out for these tasting menus and the establishment would tell you what you have to eat, in which order, and there's very little variation. He did accept that Astra that you just mentioned,
He says the chefs are holding you hostage, is essentially was his thing.
Yeah. What's going on there?
Well, I think that's more dining as theater.
Yeah.
That's going out as a theater. I mean, you know, dining out is something that we're all used to doing. Whether it's for a night out, whether it's to accompany a show or something else you're doing, you want to be pleased in the same way. But I also think nowadays that we expect a little more theater in our dining. So, you know what? If we're going to go see a Shakespeare play, we're going to pay a lot more attention to that than going to see Blue Man Group.
By the way, that's the voice of Bruce Vosica. He's the executive chef for Seasons. The other voice you've heard is Jody Adams. She is from Trade and Rialto, and they're both part of this Chef's Gala, night one of this great thing here at WGBH, the Food and Wine Festival. Marjorie, in a couple of minutes, is going to tell you how you can get tickets. When you go out to eat, Joe, you're both pretty recognizable characters, obviously, in this town. Can you go out to eat at somebody else's restaurant and not have people know who you are? And then can you actually go out and enjoy a meal?
Sometimes, yeah.
And do you choose restaurants in part in the hopes that you can actually sit there in peace and enjoy a meal like people do at your joint?
No, I choose a restaurant based on the quality of the food and the overall experience and whether or not I'm going to feel the way I want customers in my restaurant to feel, which is that you're welcomed with open arms. You're seated in as comfortable a place as possible. Not all of these small restaurants are, mm-hmm. you know, as comfortable as others. And that you're well taken care of and the food's really good. And food as theater for me is much less interesting than it used to be. And actually, Frank Bruni in the New York Times yesterday talked about restaurants as home and places where you're part of the tribe. And now that he's no longer the restaurant critic, how nice it is to go back to restaurants over and over and over again, because that's really the way he wants to eat and the kind of restaurant he wants to go to. He wants to be recognized and well taken care of.
How do you feel about cell phones in your restaurants? They drive you nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
me too.
People don't use them. Actually, people don't use them that much.
No, they don't.
They'll get up and walk away from the table, and sometimes they don't walk far enough out of the dining room, but that's just they're not paying attention. But people tend not to.
You know, people are so careful with their ringtones now, too. So it's a lot of the vibration and the buzz instead of those obnoxious ringtones we used to hear. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of refreshing to see people get up and walk away and, you know, deal with their business on that side.
Yeah, you assaulted someone in a restaurant a couple of years
ago. I did not assault someone. We were out to lunch and someone was speaking too loudly. And Marjorie said, "She is you, Jim. So you should see yourself in this person." We're talking to Jody Adams and Brooke Vosica. So the thing is tonight, 7 o'clock, 25 chefs, 23 others. Is there somebody at this thing you haven't met before, somebody's restaurant you haven't been to that you're excited
to? I'm sure there is. Yeah. You know, and actually, as we were coming in, Brooke, right, they're starting to set up.
I know, it's
very
great.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Like
is.
You can see it unfolding right now. So,
And they're going to pair the food with wines that go with it. Just one last thing. How do you figure that out? How do you figure out which wine goes with whatever we're eating over here?
You know, we kind of have a little conversation ahead of time, and I'll say exactly what I'm doing. So if it's a lobster, we're going to deal with something on a white wine level. And then we'll find out. My flavors will key in on if it's a Chardonnay, a Sauvignon Blanc, or something that has a little more Gewürztraminer or has a little more spice to it. Then I'll increase my flavors to go with that wine.
You know, as tough as your jobs are, and I even though I haven't done it, I know I used to work in a restaurant. Marjorie used to work in a restaurant.
Everybody did.
Do you wake up most days and say how lucky you are to be doing what you both have smiles on your faces in this discussion that seem to be a function of what you do? Is that fair? Well, Brooke first.
Yeah. Well, number one, I get to walk into a Four Seasons hotel every day.
I mean, not
that is kick not a out, blessing right? by itself. Nothing is. I mean, that's an absolutely incredible thing. So to work in an establishment like that alone, no matter how bad a day could be, it's never really.
You never say I should have been an accountant. No.
You don't do that for what we do, Jody, and I. It's passion.
Yeah.
It's a passion.
You get a nice view over there at the Four Seasons as well,
yes,
don't
we
you?
Do.
Well, Charles Hotel is not exactly like a rundown operation
in Harvard
Square.
That's true. Surrounded by Harvard and the Kennedy School in that amazing establishment of the Charles Hotel.
Is I assume you have a parking space there, don't you?
Excuse me?
You have a parking space
I
there,
do.
Don't you? Yeah.
I'm very
Hey, speaking
lucky.
Of that, before you go, weren't you worried about the location of your second place? I mean, if you had said, I know nothing about business, it's pretty obvious. You're shaking your head already like I have no idea what I'm talking about, which I don't. But you put it in a place where, I was just reading a review by our guest yesterday, Corby Comer, of your place, saying there's very little foot traffic. You wouldn't expect in the, weren't you worried about who'd be there for this? This is called Trade, by the way.
Yes, Trade is on the corner of Atlantic and Congress Streets, downtown Boston. We actually were pretty confident. Certainly about lunch. We knew from the get-go that Wellington was going upstairs. We were going to be fine. And Wellington has been incredibly supportive of Trade. You know, we stood there and watched the traffic over the process of the year that we were starting to talk about going in there. And we watched the foot traffic increase. And it has only increased. And I mean, we were like gangbusters from the get-go, and it hasn't stopped. And Nebo moved next door, and it's just enhanced our work there. So,
thank you both. We'll see you tonight.
Jody Adams is a James Beard Award-winning chef and the creative force behind the restaurants we've been talking about, Trade and Rialto. Brooke Vosica is the executive chef at the gorgeous Four Seasons and the most tenured chef. Congratulations to you in Four Seasons history. The Chef Gala is tonight at 7 o'clock here at WDBH. To find out more about it, go to wgbh.org/food/festival or just Google WGBH Food Wine Fest, which might be easier. Thanks again, you guys. When we come back, Christopher Lydon joins us for Open Mic. We'll get his take on what happens when the political theatrics involved in passing the Civil Rights Act become theater about a great political moment. That conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Next time on The World, we're in Wilder, Idaho, a farm town in Middle America where most residents come from Latin America. Wilder's mayor is a local and a strong supporter of immigration.
I started introducing myself to new Hispanic families as Juan Pelon, John Bald. You'd get a serious look, then they would laugh. The ice is broken. You're friends.
Welcoming new Americans to Idaho next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And New England Audi dealers with 5 new Audi TDI clean diesel models, proud sponsors of the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival 2013. You can see the new Audi A8 TDI clean diesel at newenglandaudidealers.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and here is a part of history.
The greatest leader of our time has been struck
down by the foulest deed of our time.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson and actor Bryan Cranston as LBJ. President Johnson is the subject of the play All the Way. It's now on stage at the ART. Chris Lydon joins us to go over what happens when the turmoil and tumult of the 60s is distilled to simmer down to a three-hour play. Chris, nice to see you.
Wonderful to be here. I'm still sort of tingling. I saw that show on Tuesday night. You've seen it, right?
I saw it over the weekend, yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. My first thought, just to give you the headline, was that Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad, I mean, some people think he's the reigning actor in American cinema anyway. He filled the house. That was sold wall-to-wall for the whole run, almost
sold
as
out,
soon
yep.
as it was announced. So it was he that filled the house. But by the end, Lyndon Johnson owns it. I mean, he has become Lyndon Johnson.
It didn't take that long. It's funny you say that. My one concern, when James Gandolfini died, and I was a huge Sopranos fan, one of the things, we were talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse, the television and whatever department right. there, he's fabulous. And I said, the problem is, every time I saw James Gandolfini and anything else, he was Tony Soprano to me. I worried that Bryan Cranston was going to be Walter White from Breaking Bad. The second he opened his mouth, it took me 5 seconds, and it was all LBJ all the time, at least for me. Not for you?
Well, for me, yes. And Goosebumps, when he gives that speech, I remember it, Jim. I think you do. After, you know, he's flying back on, I guess, Air Force One from Dallas, and he's saying, I want Bird at the tarmac, you know, when I land, and I want, you know, call the Congress. I want to talk to them right now. And sort of they were there within hours, surely days. And that opening line, I mean, I was mumbling it myself. All I have, I would give not to be here in this circumstance. I mean, it brought it all back. But here's the weird, the second stage of my thinking about it was simply that Breaking Bad and this split personality of nice Walter White, the chemistry teacher, and the monstrous Heisenberg, who's you know, addicting children everywhere with crystal meth, all in this body of Bryan Cranston. He's playing the both. It was somehow a model of people's split feelings, including my own, about Lyndon Johnson.
I agree completely.
I mean, so
that's great.
How much of his training for that part did he get in these last few years? Doing Walter White and his double, his evil twin.
We should just give you the shorthand for those who are not paying attention. I know Chris is going to fill in all the blanks. The story does open on the night, the play All the Way opens on the night or the day that that JFK is killed, LBJ is sworn in, and it runs through his first year through his first election. A huge part of the play is about his effort to get the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. But what you start to hear in the background, on the periphery, is his deceit and maneuvering around the Vietnam War. So there are the two sides of LBJ,
which
yes.
he knew was a fake, yeah. and McNamara knew was a fake, but they did it anyway. There's so many other. I mean, first of all, it's just a breathtaking piece of acting craft. Lyndon Johnson on his hotel bed or whatever with Lady Bird there, but writhing in his underwear with his socks on.
Yes.
Lady Bird, do you know how everybody hates me? You know, the Kennedys hate me, the press hate me, the Congress hate me, maybe you hate me, but just literally tormented. This is, of course, Robert Caro's Lyndon Johnson, the 5-6 volume crazy monster and yet incredibly effective president. And then those sessions flattering people. Senator, about your water projects there in California, you know, we can do something about that. And then smoking the Civil Rights Bill out of Judge Smith's committee, the congressman from Virginia who could bottle up anything in the Rules Committee. And Lyndon goes to work on him, thinking about younger candidates could maybe kick your ass out of there. He could do it all. He could do it all in a burst. He could do it. There's those wonderful sequences where his secretary keeps saying, you know, Martin Luther King is on the phone, J. Edgar Hoover is on the phone, Senator Russell's on the phone. And, of course, Martin Luther King has to wait. And yet there's another piece of the drama. The actor I'd never seen before, Brandon Durden, did an extraordinary job distilling the force of Martin Luther King, and all the more so because he didn't look at all like Martin Luther King. But the moral energy, the pressure to keep the voting rights bill in the Civil Rights Bill, which they didn't do, and yet
But did pass the following year. And
the following
that was the
year, but it was a big question. Yeah. It was a huge tactical question whether that belonged in the bill, you know, in the year before the election, et cetera. But the passion, the beauty, the language that Martin Luther King brought to every conversation, also the humor. He knew he was being tailed. He knew that they were bugging his whole life. I don't know. One relives history in that evening in a way that I don't think you can, even in the Caro books. It's totally different.
By the way, let me give the number if I can, Marjorie. I know you want to talk to Chris about something. 877-301-8970. If you're one of the lucky few who have seen all the way at the ART, please give us a buzz. And if you have thoughts about LBJ, sort of the split personality of LBJ, the Vietnam War on one hand, the civil rights crusades on the other, give us a call as well, 877-301-8970.
Well, that's what I did want to ask you about because, you know, you've read the Carroll biographies and you just saw this play. That was always the question I never understood, that on the one hand, Lyndon Johnson was this great cajoler. He could manipulate everybody, and he was a very forceful personality. And yet he was so disingenuous about Vietnam. I always wondered why. Why? You know, why he did that. And, of course, he ended up not running again for office. And hoping you have more insights into that than I do.
Well, I'm not sure we ever figured these things out. Well, it's a man to stump you. In 64, he hasn't been elected. He'd been kicked around by the Kennedys, wasn't welcome on Air Force One, shunned by Robert Kennedy. In this moment, when he's sworn in for the last 11 months of JFK's term, he's got something to prove. He's incredibly motivated and ambitious, but he's also feeling, as I say, neglected, tormented.
Underappreciated.
Oh, totally underappreciated.
By everybody.
And so he's got a lot to do. After the election, he wins all but five states over Barry Goldwater. It's something like Richard Nixon in his second term after he's crushed George McGovern even more from a count of states. But LBJ owned the world. There's, of course, an unmentionable part, and that's unspeakable part, but let's speak about it, that this place, this thing takes place just 50 years ago. It is the tragedy of the Kennedy story, as it strikes me now, is that he was on the way toward getting out of Vietnam, ending the Cold War with Khrushchev, settling with Castro, et cetera, doing a lot of other miraculous things. And all that was undone by Lyndon Johnson. You can't help wonder how, not that he was in on offing the president, but what he really took to be his mandate. Martin Luther King keeps saying that in the play. What does Lyndon Johnson really want? What does he want for history? What does he want in exchange? But, you know, he escalated that war. We had 500,000 American troops there before he was out of office. Kennedy did not put any sort of open and obvious American troops on the ground in Vietnam. The beginning of the national security state that keeps expanding day by day, minute by minute, sort of got the green light.
But you're only
elevation of Lyndon Johnson.
You're only given a hint of that in this play. The bulk of the on the periphery is the beginnings of the Vietnam involvement. The bulk of it is the individual interactions with the leaders that from Martin Luther King to congressional leaders, and this was the ultimate means to an end guy. He would do anything. The individual scenes with senators who were friends from the South, congresspeople who were enemies, his ability to say and do whatever it took to convince that man, I guess they were all men, I'm trying to think. I think they were all men, except when he was yelling at Lady Bird. And he was yelling at Lady Bird from time to time when he lost it.
Poor Lady Bird.
It was politics as art. And you have to believe also, had he not been the Senate Majority Leader and learned all the tricks of the trade, unlike some people who don't have that experience, like a Barack Obama or some of his predecessors, that's why he was so skilled at this art, unlike anybody probably before him or
after.
It
was a different art, as he defined it. I mean, let's talk just a little about the contrast with Obama. I mean, the scenes in the play of Lyndon Johnson, and we've seen them in photographs before, but, you know, head in his hands, absolutely in anguish about something or other. It may have been a small slight. It may have been, you know, his deepest anguish. But letting it all hang out, a raunchy joke, A gonadal joke at the ready every moment.
Never heard that as an adjective before,
well,
Chris.
But with you made hand the point, gestures, with, you know, the whole thing. Can you imagine Obama with his head in his hand saying, oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Or the physical grossness of LBJ, too. All these stories about him conducting conversations in the bathroom. And
can I show you my womb?
Oh, yeah, show you my womb. What do you have, gallbladder?
How do we feel about that in retrospect? Do we prefer the impeccable Obama style? I mean, no drama Obama, but never a crease in his pants either.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, do we miss this? Not just visceral, I mean, just
well, it's about
physical.
Outcome. Isn't it about outcomes, though? I mean, I don't want to crassly say that a la LBJ any means justify a desirable end, but the ends are the issue. If you look at the ingredients of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and what he did to get to the place
there.
He did, most of it was appalling. He lied. He promised. He threatened. I mean, there's some scenes when Bryan Cranston's face is like
that.
What's that?
You can forgive all of that,
I think.
I do forgive it all.
But there's so much that's left out, unfortunately, of this play. I mean, I'm dying for the sequel. But also, just in this one, you know, the last Caro book about the ascent to power is a tong war with him and Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy
Bobby Kennedy. It's
he
pretty
hates
clear throughout.
Bobby, and Bobby Kennedy is, we now are pretty sure, he was thinking, I've got to take this government back, and the first thing will be to find out who killed my brother and why. But he's not on stage. He's barely mentioned, except dismissively, as just sort of a kid out there that we don't want to deal with again. But that's certainly part of the story. The other part of the story is Bad Lyndon, where he bluffed and bullied and lied, and the result was horrific. And we're still suffering from, you know, the Vietnam blunders. I mean, worse than blunders.
Well, it was the same tactics that got us there, that got us some good things. One last thing, by the way.
Let's take a call. Do you want to take a call?
Yeah, I just want to say the one thing. Yeah, actually,
let's take a call because he's been waiting for a while. Gary from Webster, thank you for calling. You're on with Jim, Marjorie, and Christopher Lyon.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Marjorie, Jim, Chris. I listen often.
Thanks.
This is my fourth, fifth call. And I just wanted to say that Lyndon Johnson was your consummate wheeler and dealer.
He was.
And he had succeeded. And nothing creates hubris like success. And I must attribute my next comment to Doris Kearns Goodwin, that as a freshman representative from Texas, he got up early in the morning, went to a bakery, the only bakery in D.C. that made fresh chocolate eclairs, and would bring them to the speaker every morning.
Now, that's great.
Now, on the other hand, people who are such conniving, scheming, duplicitous people are often taken in by people whom they consider their inferiors, which he considered Curtis E. LeMay, the ultimate inferior, and chief of staff. So when they were so thoroughly convinced that if we could just carpet bomb Vietnam enough with the B-52s, it would be ours, and that Lyndon felt he could cut a deal with Ho Chi Minh, not truly understanding who Ho Chi Minh was, I think that's where the failure occurred.
Hey, Gary, thank you.
Fascinating, Gary.
For your call.
Can
so,
I just
Chris, who was
before
the,
we forget,
sure you
the,
can.
The, there's a sort of play within the play among the black activists on stage, and they're all brilliantly portrayed. Bob Moses might have been my favorite, but the arguments with Stokely Carmichael and with Roy Wilkins and the generations of black leadership about how far to push, when to go to the streets, whether to insist on the Voting Rights Act. I mean, it's a wonderful real life argument about power. And I think it was Stokely or maybe Bob Moses saying, "How can I vote for President Johnson in '64 who won't guarantee my right to vote, who won't include the Voting Rights Bill in the package?" But all of these dilemmas of tactics, the Freedom Democratic Party from Mississippi, Fannie Lou Hamer, it's all brilliantly reenacted.
Who's the one person in the play who does LBJ one better in at least one instance, who has the ability to threaten him and get a bottom line out of him? The only person, J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover, who's played brilliantly in this play, he is walking all over J. Edgar Hoover on a variety of fronts and basically fools him into going to Mississippi after the murder of some freedom marchers. However, Hoover has some dirt on LBJ and is able to get what he wants out of LBJ on a couple of fronts, including continuing his tenure, because he's got dirt from LBJ's past that he threatened to...
There was, you know, Walter Jenkins is arrested on stage. Mm-hmm. LBJ's kind of...
His chief aide, yeah.
Exactly. He was caught in the YMCA men's toilet in a then unfashionable act. And there's a nice little play with LBJ working that out with Hoover. We didn't know then, of course we do now, that J. Edgar Hoover was gay and had
a closet life. Well, that's a great moment when Bryan Cranston, as LBJ, is talking to Hoover about Jenkins and the fact that he was found in a bathroom at, where was it, the Port of the, so wherever
YMCA.
It was, with the YMCA. And all of a sudden, Cranston has a brain flash. He's looking at Hoover, walking around Hoover, and it's he has the epiphany. Oh, my God, he doesn't say it. This guy is gay, too. And Cranston plays it so brilliantly. It's,
who does you brain flashes better than Bryan Cranston?
No, he is. But are you a Breaking Bad fan? I don't.
I'm just becoming one because of this. I got to do the siege, the all-night, you know.
Yeah, the binge-watching. Yeah.
You know, the goal, obviously, in any play or movie is when you're watching an historical figure being portrayed by somebody else, for that actor or actress to become that figure. He does. I mean, he is so LBJ.
Oh, it's amazing.
And it is truly, from the accent to all of the mannerisms. That
100 mannerisms, yeah. So eyebrows and jaw and the whole bit.
Well, should give a plug to the New Yorker profile of Bryan Cranston, which is just brilliant, about his whole acting, his evolution of his life. I mean, he even interviewed the father and the sister and
the
whole
father
thing.
Who was a failed actor. And Bryan Cranston, an unsuccessful actor for many years.
Many years.
I shook his hand after it. He's an extraordinarily generous, pleasant, nice guy. And I think he loves this role. It's awkward to be advocating a play that's all sold out. On the other hand, you can get standing room tickets every day at noon. They put them on sale, and it's worth a lot of standing.
Well, you know what? An incredible experience. I went on Sunday, and if you can get a ticket, Sunday is the perfect day to go, because you see that at the 2 o'clock matinee, which is over at 5:15. And then 3 hours and 45 minutes later, you're on AMC watching Breaking Bad, and you watch LBJ morph into Walter White, chemist turns meth, crystal meth, kingpin. It is amazing that it's the same human being. I mean, what talent. It is just brilliant.
Yeah. But maybe, as you say, that is the point, that we're looking at a man about to be transformed into a meth-making monster.
So what do you take away from LBJ? I mean, you have looked at him historically. You've seen this play.
I don't like LBJ, and I hate to say it, because he was a man of colossal energy and gifts, but he took us into Vietnam in a way without reflecting, without consulting, without opening it up, and we're still, in so many ways, we're still there.
On the other hand, you wonder if without him and all his wheeling and dealing and pushing and cajoling, it would have been, who knows, how many more years before we would have gotten this great civil rights legislation? I don't know.
Is there any question that wouldn't have? I mean, if there is any truth to the historical narrative, there is not a chance in hell this thing would have passed in 64 and voting rights in 65.
Let's remember that voting rights are in danger in the Supreme Court today. I mean,
they're not in danger. They already are. They've already been put in danger by the Supreme Court ruling just a couple of months ago. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's just these things never get settled. But my considered reflection, I remember standing once in front of his desk in that Oval Office, was that the man was, he was too far out there. There was too much going on, too much mystery, too much anger, too much, you know, I don't know what, too big a bully for the schoolyard of our politics. I don't know. That's an unsatisfactory answer. He did great things, and he wounded this country in ways that are still bleeding.
So why do you think he pushed so hard for the civil rights thing? Because it was the right thing to do, or because it would have put him in the history books, or because he knew it was happening?
My sense is he believed it. He'd grown up poor. He was not a racially prejudiced man. I remember George Thames, a wonderful New York Times photographer, who heard marvelous things from politicians because they knew he wasn't writing and they could talk in front of them. And he heard Lyndon Johnson signing that civil rights bill, or maybe the voting rights bill, and John Gardner, his health, education, welfare secretary, standing by. And he said, "John, I want this. I want every." And he sort of listed in the most incorrect language all the cleaning ladies, all the laborers, all the street workers, all the impoverished people, black, too, that he wanted to register. And then there's that moment where he said to Richard Russell, you know, we're exploding the foundations of the Democratic dominance in this country, the solid South.
The South,
and
right.
We'll never see it again, Dick. There was courage there. There was a decision. And I don't for a moment question his motivation or his guts
And he did the anti-poverty. He did all the anti-poverty
absolutely.
Programs,
the
too.
Whole great
I mean, the Great Society.
Society. Yep.
Absolutely.
I think
wasn't
he
Corporation for Public... Is Corporation for Public Broadcasting...
I believe that was in his time.
Believe it or not, Richard Nixon started a lot of that.
Well, I'm a former legal services lawyer. Office of Economic Opportunity was a creation of Richard Nixon, which is hard to believe. So what Chris Leidner both saying is use the same qualities that Lyndon Johnson used to get the Civil Rights Act to get into the ART to see this. You should lie,
I could help with your water project there, yeah.
Hey, Chris Leidner, that was great. And you really do have to see it. It is sold out. Figure out a way to get in. He is brilliant, Bryan Cranston,
ticket in New York. That's where it's going.
Apparently it is.
It is going to go to Broadway.
Well, it's not 100%, but it's pretty clear it's gone, right?
I think so, for sure.
Down in time.
Chris, good to see you.
Bless you. Thank you.
Christopher Leidner, thank you very much, as always. Chris Leidner is with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic, and all the way at the ART runs through October 12th. As we've been saying before, it is sold out, but you can buy standing room tickets. To learn more about that, go to AmericanRepertoryTheater.org. And when we come back, Karen Miller joins us to talk about what makes an innovator. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This May is race. It's complicated and complex.
WGBH News political contributor Peter Katsas.
I'm really, really impressed with the goodwill and high quality of the candidates that are running. But looking ahead, we have to get them to be specific, to talk about what they really want to change.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum, presenting the Rappaport Prize Lecture with painter Anne Pybl at Mass College of Art and Design, September 26th at 6:30 p.m. All are welcome. DeCordova.org. And the Castle Group, PR, digital media, and events partner to businesses that value local connections, international reach, and marketing intelligence, connecting Castle clients with their audiences for 17 years. TheCastleGRP.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and I are still eating the food left behind by the chief chef.
And I am too.
O'Kara is now too. And
it's really good.
It's
really like avocado French fries.
Chef's Gala tonight. A couple of tickets left still at WGBH.org. Is that where they find them? Is that what the website was, Marjorie?
Yes, WGBH.org. Let me look.
She's going to look. In any case, while she's...
Oh. You can also find out on AmericanRepertoryTheater.org. Now, that's the wrong place.
Thank you, Marjorie. Good. Okay.
Okay, Jim, what is the website, Jim? Why don't you tell everybody?
Here joining us in Studio 3, we'll check it out for you in a second, is Karen Miller, obviously the host of the Innovation Hub. This week, we're diving into the past with a look at historic innovators and what made them tick. And by the way, while Kara is bringing us some history of some of the great creative minds, if you see people, you can't mention Steve Jobs. That's the one thing because it's too predictable and easy. If there's somebody in your life, somebody famous, somebody you work with, who has this incredible creative spirit, describe it to us at 877-301-8970. Or if you think there's a current innovator who's going to be remembered like the ones that Kara mentions, give us a buzz with those too.
Okay, so tell us about a couple of great historic innovators.
You know, so one of the questions we wanted to look at is what does it take to really, you know, get to the top of your field, to be one of those people who create something new? And I think that, you know, very often it takes being a little different. So let me just, since, you know, Steve Jobs is the obvious example, let me just take Steve Jobs for a second.
Fairly.
So Steve Jobs, one of the things he did, Nancy Kane, who you've had on this show.
Yes, she's terrific.
That one of the things that Steve Jobs is said to have done is ripped out basically multiple lighting schemes for the Apple stores because he wanted the lighting on the iMacs, on the iPads, on all these things to be just right so that they sparkled in just the right way. You go back to 1984. We also talked to Joshua Kendall, who interestingly also gives Steve Jobs as an example. He takes us back to 1984. Steve Jobs takes his father, his adoptive father, and they go on a tour of the Apple factory. And Steve Jobs will go into this factory with white gloves and put his hands on machines. This is a factory. Nobody's ever going to see this who's purchasing Apple products. And if there's a speck of dust, he wants it clean so people can, like, eat off of these machines. I mean, it's a kind of obsessiveness. But it also leads to the sort of great, clean lines of Apple. I mean, it's this sort of dark side, but in a way, it also leads to greatness.
I'm just going to say, I just bought my first Apple computer.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's sort of a thrill about using it is that the way it's lit from underneath.
Yeah.
Every detail.
My old computer, my trash Toshibas and all the other ones I've had over the years – never looked like that when I was writing on them. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, an interesting thing, you know, he was so into sort of cleanliness and this really spare design. I haven't seen your Apple computer, but if you look at it, I bet it doesn't say Apple on it. It just has that Apple on the lid,
yeah.
Right?
It's MacBook Air. That's what it says.
Okay, MacBook Air. So, it even we know the brand so well, you can even dispense with the name of the, I'm serious.
Right.
Sort of pick up your iPhone and look for the word Apple on it. I don't even know if you're going to find it.
You know, you mentioned Jobs and his obsession with minutia. Yesterday, we were talking to Edgar B. Herrick III about Tesla.
Yes.
And the guy in the piece by Joshua Kendall, you were kind enough to share with us. He talks about, is it Elon Musk, how you pronounce it?
Exactly.
The guy behind Tesla, who has the same obsession with minutia.
Right.
Is that a thread? I know you're going to give us some examples from history. Is that a thread that runs through most of these creative, innovative geniuses?
Yeah, it's a lot of people. You know, Marissa Mayer, who used to be at Google and is now the CEO of Yahoo.
Yeah.
And basically her job used to be at Google, sort of the keeper of that Google search page that we're all so familiar with. And she said, interestingly, unlike the people at Yahoo at the time, don't put anything else on this page. I don't care. You know what I mean? People were like, I know what we could do. We could put ads on it, and we could have pictures, and we could put links. And she was like, no, that's not happening. It's going to be white, and it's going to be clean, and it's going to have a clear purpose. And when people come to the page, they're going to know exactly what it was for. And that's sort of part of the genius of Google, is that you have that really, really clean, clear page. And now that she's at Yahoo, I mean, Business Insider recently wrote a piece about her and said that she is absurd in her obsession with detail. That's a quote.
But, you know, but you read.
Yeah.
And I know we're going to get into the historical ones, some of the greats in a moment. But what you read from some of the great CEOs in either the books or interviews, they say almost always the first item on the list, what do you need to do to be successful? You need to be able to delegate. You need to trust other people. It sounds like the generic Steve Jobs in this case.
Yeah.
What you're talking about.
He wasn't
delegating. It isn't all about delegation at all. It's about ordering. Based upon your obsession with every little facet of everything you do.
So, you know, a couple of weeks ago on the show, I talked to Guy Kawasaki, who used to be the chief evangelist at Apple. And, like, one of my questions to him was, now he works for Google, which bought Motorola with some, you know, I think told you some change they found lying around in the couch cushions. And they're like, we need some phones. Buy Motorola. So anyway, he works for Motorola now. And I said, you know, what has been the difference in moving from Apple to Google, like one big tech titan to another tech titan? And he was like, yeah, well, you know, Apple was a very unusual structure. It was like Steve Jobs and then 10,000 people who reported directly to him. And I was like, wow, so he must have been a busy guy. And he was like, he was a busy, busy guy. But it taught me one thing. This is what Guy Kawasaki said. A dictatorship can really work. You just have to have the right dictator.
We're talking to Karen Miller for the Innovation Hub. Go back a little bit. I mean, give us a couple of figures from history.
Here's who I want to hear about.
Who's that?
Estee Lauder.
Yeah.
Tell us about Estee Lauder. I find the stories about her fascinating.
Yeah, so we talk about Estee Lauder on the show, and Nancy Kane is actually a real specialist on Estee Lauder.
Harvard Business School.
Yeah, Harvard Business School. And one of the really interesting things about Estee Lauder, which kind of gets to, Jim, your question before about this idea of, you have to delegate, and the things that you read about in business books or that you hear in business schools – Think about the Steve Jobs or the Estee Lauders. These were not people who went to business school. Steve Jobs didn't even go to college. I mean, these were dropouts. These were people who were basically learning on the street. And they were learning very quickly and figuring out, okay, how do we make this happen? So Estee Lauder was really interesting because she developed a makeup business at a time that there was no makeup industry. So she was trying to sell something, you know, at a time when she had no idea. In fact, Steve Jobs did this, right? He was trying to create things. Who knew that there was a market for iPads? There was no such thing right before. So she had to make...
When was she? The early 1900s?
Yeah, okay, early 1900s. And, you know, in the mid, you know, 19-teens, many people didn't have toothbrushes.
Right.
In America, they didn't know what mascara was or rouge or foundation. They had never heard of these things. And then one of the interesting things is that she found during the Depression, so she had started off in earnest in the teens, she found in the Depression that certain things during bad times people still buy. They buy alcohol, they buy ice cream and candy, and they buy makeup. They buy the things that are going to make them feel better. They buy movie tickets, too, which is why, like, Shirley Temple was such a big deal in the Depression, because people buy things that make them feel better, like that little bit of money that's escapism. And so she continued – it continued to grow and grow. But, you know, she was obsessive, too. I mean, she's actually been talked about as somebody who kind of had two personalities. She was somebody who – in person was a real hard driver. If you knew her as a, you know, she would leave her kids at home for half the year. She had two sons and she would just get on trains. There were no planes. She'd get on trains, in cars, and crisscross the country trying to sell her stuff to department stores. So she left these kids at home. But then when she met you and she was trying to sell you something, she was the most charming person you could ever imagine. Nancy Kane tells these great stories where she would say, give me your right hand. And she would put fragrance on it and stuff because the idea was most people use their right hand more, except Marjorie and I, who are left-handed.
That's right.
But, you know, the idea was they would remember. They would remember the impression that you gave them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she also, I remember reading that she marketed it in a way. She didn't want to just go into cheap places. You know, she wanted to make sure that she was going into the department stores, which are higher end.
Yeah.
So she would be associated with that sort of higher end, more luxurious part of the market,
I guess. Well, one interesting thing to start with is that her name was not Estee Lauder.
What was her name?
Josephine Esther Menser.
Oh, my goodness.
Forget that.
Same panache. So you guys...
It's hard to fit that on a jar.
Have you known anybody who is incredibly creative or hard-charging in business? What do you think set them apart? Were there weird quirks that they had? And what do you think it takes to be this kind of creative, innovative soul? The number is 877-301-8970. Also on your list, Kara Miller from the Innovation Hub, is, I don't know if this is technically right, the great-great-grandfather-in-law of Secretary of State John Kerry. Is that a fair way to describe?
Yeah, yeah.
H.J. Hines?
I don't know about the relationship.
Like okay.
But yeah, H.J. Hines, the ketchup baron, who we also talk about, obsessed.
When was this? When did he start this thing?
He was in the, I believe, in the 1860s, 1870s. Okay. And he, too, is basically at the beginning of a market that essentially didn't exist. There was no packaged food market. Like, women cooked food at home. And so he was also, like Steve Jobs, totally obsessed with cleanliness. So he said, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put food in glass jars. People aren't used to packaged food. They need to know that it's totally clean inside. We have nothing to hide. So you think about the way ketchup jars are now, right? You can see exactly
that's
how much ketchup
right.
is in
that's
them.
Right.
But that's not the way things that used to be. So he started off that way. He started off in this very poor German family, and he became obsessed. He was also obsessed with numbers. Well, which is not surprising, because what's Heinz?
57.
You got
27,
it.
27. Yeah.
And by the time he developed Heinz, that number, 57, they already had over 60 products. But he was like, no, 60 is not good. 58's not good. 57.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So was that a lucky number, or just thought that was something that people remember?
He just thought it would like catch on. Although I think when his son had a child, he wrote him a letter and was like, welcome, Heinz number 58.
It's actually sort of cute.
What is the 57? The sauce?
57 varieties
sauce.
Is what
yeah,
they
varieties.
Call
it. But it was, of course, not the 57th variety, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. We talked to Tavis Smiley also in this program, and he's not, I wouldn't call him an obsessive innovator, but one of the things he said is very early on in his career, he got burned. He lost the right to his name on the internet. You know how you can get like TavisSmiley.com or .org or .net? Somebody else saw that he was, you know, his star was on the rise, and they bought that. And he, every single year, the price has gone up. And he missed out on it. And he has become, he told me, like totally obsessive now about any new tech thing that comes. Like he will be the first person on Twitter. Like he doesn't care because he is so afraid of, I think his phrase was, becoming roadkill on the information superhighway.
And what are, you know, how about these people in real life? We were talking about the one common thread being their obsession with minutia, with detail. How about, do any of them have lives? I mean, most of us are more familiar with Steve Jobs than I said we wouldn't obsess with. Well, we all learned a lot about him, obviously, thanks to Walter Isaacson of late. But were any of these people moderately normal people, or were they all the Estee Lauders who are on the trains leaving the kids behind? Steve Jobs, who was leaving everybody behind. I don't know what Heinz's life
was
like.
I don't want to diagnose everybody, but let's talk for a minute about H.J. Heinz. H.J. Heinz was so obsessed with numbers that he would get up in the middle of meetings. He always carried a tape measure around with him and measure the door frame. So if that answers your question about was he normal. Yeah.
Why do you do that? Do you have any idea?
He was just obsessed with numbers. Mm-hmm. He would go to Europe and look at how many steps he went and write it down every day. He would look at how many people were in steerage class and write that down.
It
gets
like
weirder.
An OCD. I mean, he obviously had go ahead.
Yeah, well, so Josh Kendall, who writes about H.J. Heinz and who we have on the show talking about him, as well as Melville Dewey, the creator of the Dewey Decimal System.
Guy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You could see him really being detail. The Dewey Decimal
But go ahead,
points.
You were saying that Josh Kendall says what?
Yeah, well, I mean, he says that he believes these people have obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, which is not OCD. It's OCPD. So he actually says there's OCD tends to be paralyzing. So he gives the example of Howard Hughes, who would sit alone in his hotel room all day because he was just terrified of germs. I think he sat there naked. He was, like, terrified to leave this hotel room. Whereas Steve Jobs was also very against germs, but it pushed him to go to the factories and to make sure that there was no dirt and to make sure everything was clean lines at Apple and all that. So there's a difference between something that's obsessive and pushes you to the top and something that's obsessive and, like, keeps you inside all day and you can't do anything.
I know we don't want to talk too much about Steve Jobs.
Well, we have already violated my prescription.
I remember reading that book, Walter Isaacson's book, and talking about how he was so obsessive about everything. He lived in empty rooms in an empty house for like years because he was so obsessive about getting the right piece of furniture. There's a great picture of him sitting in a room, nothing in it but a lamp.
That's pretty good.
He's on the floor. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Clean lines.
Let's take a call from Caroline from Arlington. Are you an obsessive compulsive numbers person doing the Dewey Decimal System, Caroline?
Hey, Caroline. Caroline?
I read a book a while ago about called Born to Rebel, and it's about how scientific innovators are very often the youngest children in their family. They don't have an automatic respect for authority, so they question everything. And I'm just wondering whether that has something to do with innovators like Steve Jobs or whether that's something in line with what the author there is talking about.
How about that? That's a great
thought. It's a very interesting question.
Caroline.
I mean, like, so for example, Larry Ellison, who, you know, really rich guy, started Oracle. He had a very contentious relationship with his family. Steve Jobs had a good relationship, but obviously there is that kind of level of complication where he knew he had been given up for adoption. So the good relationship he has is with his adoptive parents. And there's that story, you know, of him sort of knowing where his real father worked.
Yes.
I think his father was a Syrian immigrant, right?
Yes.
At a restaurant.
He worked
at
a restaurant, yeah. and he knew that he worked there, but he never introduced himself to the father.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Dewey and Heinz they grew up in families where there were hardships, where there were hard times, and they were always kind of obsessed with trying to make things better, trying to sort of restore order to their lives. They had a connection with their mother and trying to sort of fix that. But that's a very interesting question, and I think different people would say different things. Josh Kendall talks about Jack Welch, the former head of GE, as having a real, real hard-driving mother, and that really pushed him, this sort of very, you know, know, fierce Irish mother who said, like, you know, we don't act this way. This is, you know, I guess one time I think he threw his hockey stick after a hockey game, and the mother was like, would have none of that. And so I do think there's probably a family factor in here.
How about the Dewey Decimal System guy? Tell us some more about the Mr. Dewey Decimal.
Well, I'll start at the end.
I guess his name wasn't Mr. Dewey.
Was Melville.
His name was Melville.
I didn't
Melville.
Know that till this morning, yeah. Actually. I didn't know he had a first name. I was with Marjorie.
Mr. Dewey Decimal.
Exactly.
Actually, it was Dewey Decimal Point. That was his name.
So, I mean, this is a guy who, at 5 years old, was organizing his mother's spice cabinet. Like, he was obsessed. Also obsessed, just like H.J. Hines, with numbers. He actually went to Amherst College in Massachusetts.
Really?
And at that time, things were completely disorganized in libraries. People just kind of threw things on shelves. And he got this, like, part-time job at the Amherst Library. And all of a sudden, he realized, oh, my God, this is my calling. I have to fix libraries. And so, you know, to sort of catapult over a lot of his life, by the end of his life, so here's the good side and the bad side. He revolutionizes the way that libraries are organized. He says, look, we've got to, you know, impose some order here. He helps start a library school at Columbia. But then you get to the end. He created, basically, the American Library Association. He is thrown out of the American Library Association because he essentially is like a serial sexual harasser, and he harasses
so?
Librarians. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
And
it was the Decimals that drove him to it.
So essentially, when you talk about these people, and we've mentioned Jobs 4,000 times, it's mostly the people that come to mind most quickly are the people who are in the computer world. The two guys, and one of the pieces we were reading this morning, the two guys who founded Google are essentially Melville, I was going to say Melville Decimal. That's not his name, yeah. Melville Dewey.
No, Sergey Brin.
Right, of the 21st century, aren't they? I mean, isn't that how they're going to be seen in 100 years?
Well, Sergey Brin has been talked about as, like, also very, very sort of detail-oriented, extremely tunnel-visioned. Now, but you think about this. These are not the people. Who's the CEO of IBM?
I have no idea.
Exactly. This is we're not talking about people who are just like the 28th CEO of IBM. We're not talking
it's
about
the
that.
Creators.
We are talking about, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're talking about, you think about the social network and Mark Zuckerberg. We're talking about the people who were there at day one, who created things, not the people who went to, you know, the Wharton School probably. These are people who may have had no formal education, but they were so darn driven that they created a makeup industry where there was no makeup industry, right? That they did things that nobody even thought
so
of
mention,
doing.
So mention,
don't you have to kind of have blinders on to
I think
be
you
that
do.
Person?
Give us, other than the ones you've mentioned, give us a couple of people who you've looked at in the contemporary life who maybe aren't as well known, who are likely to be seen in that way 20, 30, 50 years from now.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to have to think about that. I don't know if I have that answer right off the bat. I mean, Marissa Mayer, she's trying to turn around Yahoo. It's possible she's going to, you know, be able to do that. I'm going to think about that.
Okay, we'll allow you to think about
it. I don't know if Marissa Mayer is letting her fellow female workers have their little playpens.
I know.
In the office.
Would like to go in and see that nursery. It's so interesting because she and I had our babies right around the same time, and that whole memo that came out saying, you know, that she
gets the playpen, everybody else has to.
Exactly. I think that would be very interesting to see. Yeah.
Brenda on 495 has a very quick nominee. We're short on time, Brenda. Who is your innovator nominee?
Oh, I worked for a man named Roger Black. He was the art director of Rolling Stone, New York Times Magazine, and Newsweek. I worked for him while he was the art director at Newsweek.
Ooh.
And the thing that was the most vivid in my mind when you said characteristics of innovators is that Roger was, and I believe these other people might well be, pretty much intrigued with themselves. You know, just this side of narcissism, there's this belief that what I'm doing today, what I'm thinking about today, what I'm going to draw today, what I'm going to take the New York Times Magazine to wide body, and I'm going to draw a new font for the Rolling Stone Magazine, and Newsweek Magazine is going to use illustrators for the first time ever in Katharine Graham's face. This is necessary for this magazine to be current. He always believed fully that these were great ideas.
I love that you called, and I love that contribution.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah.
Brenda, thank you. And
I'll just add Jack Dorsey, who created Twitter and has now created Square, kind of obsessive, a little bit hard to deal with people. He may be one of those people.
What's on Innovation Hub tonight at 9 o'clock, please, Kara Miller?
Recreating healthcare, and then Saturday is this obsessive innovator show.
Oh, God, I got to listen to this one. Kara Miller is the host.
Oh, but I want to say again, I add, well, you do who, say who she is, and I want to add the wine and the
Kara
wine.
Kara Miller, she's over there. She is the host of Innovation Hub, Jim. She's going to be on tonight at 9 o'clock and Saturday at 10 o'clock. I love your segments, Kara.
Thanks.
And the Wine and Food Festival, the Food and Wine Festival we talked about. You want to get tickets? There are a few left for the Chef's Gala tonight. Google WGBH Food Wine Fest.
And please do tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Emily Rooney and her world-famous Emily's List of her quirky complaints and our Friday news quiz. We've got two meteorologists, Dave Epstein and Matt Noyes from NECN.
See you
tomorrow. Thanks for listening.